Like all the other speakers, I want to thank the organizers for what has been a very stimulating conference. I'm certainly enjoying myself. And I also want to thank them for organizing this little discussion we had on Tuesday. I'm sure people have many different feelings about it, but I certainly enjoy hearing what people are thinking about and also enjoy hearing what people's view is of some of the recent developments, but what Joe called the previous revolution. But despite the mood, I'm going to talk about the landscape. And of course, there's some people I hopefully are still at lunch. But more seriously, you know, I understand all of the negative feelings that people have. But on the other hand, I also was thinking a little bit about Nima's talk the other day and his reminder to us that we have something like 26 months before the LHC. And right now, to my mind, the only real game in town for thinking about really string theory and accelerator physics, string theory and what we think of traditionally as particle physics, is the landscape. And it may succeed, it may not, it may be wrong-headed for all kinds of reasons, but I'm willing to spend a little more time thinking about it. So, what's happened here? There we go. All right, so, I say the landscape poses a lot of challenges for our understanding of string theory. But also, for the first time, it provides a framework which might allow us to connect string theory to nature. And in particular, I really have in mind the Large Hadron Collider, and I have in mind also the sorts of ideas that Joe spoke about. Okay. So what is the landscape? Okay, well, we use that term rather loosely, but there's really something particular we have in mind, because we know about lots of nice string vacua. So we know about supersymmetric flat space solutions where a number of supersymmetries is greater than 4, and for these there's a continuous infinity. Okay, we know about supersymmetric ABS with supersymmetry n-sufi greater than 4. Okay, more than 4 supersymmetries, and again we have a continuous infinity, and we also have discrete infinities. Okay. We have supersymmetric ABS with and supersymmetry equals 4 now. This is what we heard about from Shamit, and we heard also a little bit from Michael. These are 2A theories where one has discrete infinities. One at least doesn't have this continuous one, okay, which have been developed recently by a number of people, but most, I think most precisely by de Wolf et al. Okay. But I think the source of current interest in the landscape comes from what we think are non-supersymmetric ABS and DS solutions, and De Sitter and anti-De Sitter solutions. Okay. These we heard about in a beautiful talk on Tuesday morning by Frederick Dinesh. Okay. And there are many challenges in understanding these. First of all, as Michael in fact talked about, are the number of these finite or infinite? We certainly like to know that. We can back up and ask more fundamental questions. For those of you who don't like the landscape, I really recommend you focus on this one. Explain perhaps why the states which we find in some crude approximation stationary points of an effective field theory, why perhaps those don't really correspond to quantum gravity systems. Okay. If we assume the landscape exists, we need to formulate a sensible cosmology. A number of people have alluded to this. And we need to determine sort of how different states might be weighted. Okay, we have to think about select one fifth of us, I guess. Think we have to think about selection effects. And if you are on the other side of that issue, I recommend for the moment you hold your nose and think about them a little bit anyway. And in particular, what I have in mind here is the problem, even if you say, I'm willing to invoke the anthropic principle, what does that mean? How do you actually implement that? And I'll talk a little bit, not a great length, but some of the issues involved with that. Okay. Even, as I say, granted some anthropic selection, it's hard to understand how the landscape picture can reproduce many features of the laws of nature at low energies. And one of the ones that troubled me from the beginning is theta QCD, something we heard a lot about from Ed Witten. Why can't one solve this problem in the landscape with axions? Well, maybe you can, but for example, if you look at the KKLT construction that Frederick talked about, one has there, to first approximation, some rough supersymmetry with all moduli fixed. Okay, so there aren't any axions. Now, maybe there are other things which lead to axions and so on, so I'm not saying that this is by any means the last word, but this is certainly a problem, a question which one would like to address here. So even, I say, granted, you know, even doing this, it's not obvious that all this is going to work. But today I'm going to be more upbeat and more optimistic about this. I'm not going to worry about all these questions, and I'm going to ask whether or not there might be paths to making predictions in the landscape. Okay, and I'm going to focus in this talk largely on the sorts of vacua that Frederick talked about in his talk, and you can certainly question that and think about other sets, but just as a model, if you like, for how things might work. Okay. I'm going to look at these 2B vacua. Okay? So the kinds of questions I'm going to ask are, can we hope to make predictions? And we've heard a lot about naturalness in this meeting, and I really would stress that the most promising questions where we might hope to make some progress are related to traditional issues of naturalness. So in some sense, this is kind of the flip side of some of the things that Nima said. After all, the problem of naturalness is precisely the issue that some features of the standard model seem improbable. And these are precisely the sorts of questions for which statistics might be useful. Okay. As I say, while some sort of anthropic selection may be required to understand features of nature, this does not mean that prediction is impossible. And the question is essentially in a kind of statistical framework, one of correlations. For example, if I given the values of the cosmological constant and the Fermi constant, okay, might that imply supersymmetry or Randall-Sundrum or Technicolor or nothing at all? Okay. Now, in this talk, I'm going to identify 3 branches of the landscape distinguished by the statistics of supersymmetry breaking on each. Okay, and within each branch, the statistics, as we'll see, are generic. Okay, and in fact, I'll elaborate a little bit some of the things Frederick said on this topic the other day. The relative numbers of states on each branch require a much more microphysical understanding. Okay, and within particular branches, more detailed, Zine argue that more detailed phenomenological predictions may be possible. So it's probably not true that all metastable de Sitter vacua in the landscape are equally probable, but I'm going to adopt that sort of naive view anyway. Okay, just because I don't know what else to do. So I'm going to proceed on the assumption that the more states I can find with some particular property, the more likely that property. And my prejudice for that, or my only excuse for that, is to say that if one views Weinberg's argument as having successfully predicted the value of the cosmological constant, then more or less by definition, there had to have been some roughly democratic sampling of the state. Okay, this, of course, need not be right. Okay. And I don't want to elaborate too much on this, but my view of the anthropic principle is also not that I know what are the values of all the constants of nature required for, you know, human beings or stars or galaxies or whatever your criterion are. I think the best we are likely to be able to hope to do is to say if some parameter changes by some amount with all the others fixed, we die. And so I'm willing to, for any parameter like that, I'm willing to say, let's just impose that as a prior, if you like, on the landscape. And if we can get a prediction out of that, that would be, I would view that as a big success. Okay? And I won't succeed in doing that today, so if you don't like it, it doesn't really matter. I'm really safe. Okay? But, we quoted Einstein a lot. I'm going back to earlier sources. This is a sort of Faustian bargain, I think. I claim if we can do statistics well enough and we are willing to impose priors using such rules, this would be the first predictive framework for string theory. Okay, so we heard a lot from Frederick about the KKLT construction, and I don't really have time to review it here, but I just want to establish a couple features. First of all, in that case, there are various moduli. There are the complex structure moduli in the dilaton. There are some Taylor moduli, which describe the size of the internal space. Okay, and the procedure of KKLT was basically to integrate out the complex structure moduli, okay, to obtain a superpotential for the Taylor moduli. So one had something like W is W naught plus e to the I c rho. This was some non-perturbative contribution to the Taylor potential, and this leads to a fixing of rho. Okay. And so what they found, what they argued was, in fact, it was rather easy to imagine that all moduli are fixed. Okay, and they even argued that perhaps if W naught is less than one, one has at least a roughly valid approximation. Okay. They also suggested a mechanism to obtain supersymmetry breaking, which I want to mention as a kind of paradigm for the things I'm going to think about, where they add anti-D3 brains to these configurations near, again, as Frederick reminded us, near warp conifolds. Okay. And this, they argued, could give rise to hierarchically small supersymmetry breaking, again, in a roughly controlled approximation. Okay. Now, Michael and his collaborators have stressed to us the importance of doing statistics, and I think I'm not going to go through this again because Frederick reviewed it. Okay, but they did a number of things. They counted in various cases the number of supersymmetric vacua, of course, and found it's exponentially large. They found the distribution of W naught, of that parameter W naught. Okay, I don't know if you can read this here, but I just want to say that in a sense they found this, but in a sense it's not a surprise. Because if you have any distribution in W naught at all, and if it's reasonably smooth near the origin, if the origin's not a special place, then at least for small W naught, one will get a flat distribution. Okay. They found the distribution of coupling constants. They discussed the distribution of warping scales, and as Frederick reminded us also, this distribution is what you'd expect in a situation which is dual to some sort of gauge dynamics. And they also discussed the distribution of states with broken supersymmetry and small cosmological constants. Okay, so they also found the result. This should have a factor of lambda out front, and this goes like x to the sixth. And I'll review also this explanation of this, a simple explanation for this shortly. Okay. So within this kind of counting, I want to distinguish three branches. Okay, and then I'm going to first distinguish them by talking about behavior. Equal to zero. Okay. States with unbroken supersymmetry and W naught equals zero, and states with broken supersymmetry at tree level. And all three of these sorts of states they studied. Now, these distinctions, though, are not by themselves sharp. In field theory, for example, and even in string theory, we know that non-perturbative effects can break supersymmetry and give rise, for example, to a non-vanishing W. So all these things are statements about some classical or semi-classical approximation. But we will see that there is a sharp distinction, in a sense, between three classes of states. Okay, that there are three branches of three sets of states, and what distinguishes them is not that W is equal to zero, but what distinguishes them is their statistics. Okay, so let me talk about each of these branches in turn. So first, let me talk about supersymmetry breaking on this W not equal to zero branch. I refer to this as the intermediate scale branch, because it sort of reminds me, at least, of sort of intermediate scale supersymmetry breaking, things that Joe and others taught us about years ago. Okay. So if we think about this KKLT construction, basically what they argued is that the supersymmetry breaking scales would be proportional to these warping scales. This would go like, then the distribution would go like the distribution of warping scales. And this is also like one would expect to find if one had dynamical supersymmetry breaking. So as an alternative, you could just imagine that the low energy theory is a theory which breaks supersymmetry dynamically, and both of these sorts of ideas would lead to the same sort of distribution. Now, this, when I first thought about this, and I think others as well, I said, oh, well, you know, this might lead you to think that this plus the cosmological constant would lead you to predict low energy supersymmetry, but by itself, that's not enough. Okay, as a simplified model, we can think of a cosmological constant as being this mu, which our mu here is a dynamical scale. It'll be mu will stand for something else, unfortunately, on the next transparency. But so this is some dynamically generated scale minus 3 times this W naught squared. Okay, we know the distribution of W naught, and I'm assuming I know this is actually that's what I called M Susi or M 3 halves before. It would have been better to call it that. So this distribution, though, we know this distribution, we know. We can ask, what are the fraction of states with cosmological constant less than some lambda naught? Okay. And we can, for example, integrate over couplings, leaving an integral over W naught, and we get a distribution which is basically flat in W naught or M3 halves on a log scale. So no particular scale is preferred by this. Now, imposing the value of the weak scale as an additional requirement can favor supersymmetry breaking at the weak scale. Okay, and this is a realization, really, of conventional naturalness. So someone talked, I think, Nima talked about, you know, imagining this godlike figure. Okay, and this is a, you know, but this is a you know, tuning a dial, but this is a much more plausible notion of how, you know, our conventional ideas of naturalness might arise. And so I say, if we impose a weak scale, I'm not going to, again, don't have time to do this in detail, but it's pretty simple. Mu is now the mu parameter of the MSSM. So again, as a kind of model for what might happen, I'm writing this as an expression for the Higgs mass. And then you ask, well, suppose we require that the Higgs mass be less than a TeV, well, then the distribution of this mu, not the other mu, is important. Okay. And if, for example, it's flat, then you still get a flat distribution. Okay. And supersymmetry doesn't really win. It doesn't buy you anything. Okay. If, on the other hand, the mu term, for example, were itself to arise dynamically, then you would favor lower energy breaking of supersymmetry. Okay. So I want to mention these other couple of branches quickly. First, the W equals zero branch. Okay. I like this one, though. I'm getting a little disappointed with it. So there are classes of states with W naught equals zero at tree level, and so there's sort of a delta function distribution. One might expect that then the W naught could be generated dynamically in some fraction of cases. For example, Gugino condensation, well, it doesn't usually break supersymmetry, always generates a superpotential. And so you might generate, again, a distribution like this. Okay? The first thing you might ask is, well, I gave you an argument how I understood that the distribution of W naught before was flat. Okay, and well, why isn't that right here? Why isn't that true here? Okay, and the point here is that W equals zero can be a symmetry point, a special point in the space of states, a place with unbroken R symmetries. Okay, and so there need not be a Taylor series of expansion of this, and in general, there won't be. Okay. So what about the scale of supersymmetry breaking? Well, you repeat this earlier counting, you get a different sort of distribution. Just thinking about the cosmological constant, you favor low scale breaking. Okay, so very low energy breaking is significantly favored. And I'd like to pause here because, you know, I think we have a lot of complaints that the landscape doesn't give us anything, and I'm not claiming that this is so much, but this result for me was quite surprising because people have talked about things like gauge mediation for many years, but there's never been any motivation for where the scale should be. Okay? And this suggests that on this branch, you might have something like gauge mediation. Okay? And the lowest possible scale, say, consistent with a weak scale, would be favored. Okay? And so that seems striking to me. So this is my little, I didn't look up a logo or something, but this would be my little advertisement. Okay. Now, what's perhaps appealing about this set of states is they're relatively easy to count. Okay, well, I mean, I'm not sure Oliver will agree with me, but they're easier than other things. But if you, for example, if you just one way, so some counting of these states has been done recently. Okay, and there's earlier counting as well, which I mentioned before. So suppose that at some point in the moduli states, in the absence of fluxes, there's a discrete R symmetry. Okay, then under the symmetry, W transforms by a phase. Okay, if there are a number of fields, Zi, which also transform by alpha, and some other number, phi, which are neutral, then the superpotential has a form roughly like this. Okay, and you can ask, can you find a solution with Z equals zero and dW dZ equals zero? Okay, this would be unbroken supersymmetry and W equals zero. And the answer is, generically, yes, if there are more of these kind of fields than these. So really, so this is the kind of thing you might want to just count. Okay. So in the Calabi-Yau case, there's a pairing of complex structure moduli and fluxes, and the pairing is such that if the flux is neutral, the corresponding modulus transforms like the superpotential. You can only turn on neutral fluxes if the low-energy Lagrangian is to preserve the symmetry, and in order to have a large number of states and a small number of vanishing fluxes, we have to have a large number of fields which transform into the symmetry. So we want to be in the limit n greater than m above. Okay? So if there's not to be a big suppression, we're going to break supersymmetry. Okay? In fact, I don't have time to review this counting. I'll just flash this on here just to indicate that it's not hard to do. If you do this sort of counting, you actually discover that, in fact, there is typically a big suppression, that typically only a small fraction of the fluxes can be turned on, maybe as much as a third or so, okay, and preserve a symmetry. Okay. I should add also, though, that one thing that's interesting about this kind of analysis is you can also ask about sort of Z2R parity, the kind of thing that model builders include all the time in the MSSM. Okay? These actually are very common in the landscape. There doesn't seem to be a big price for these. Okay. So I don't have time, I guess I don't have much time left. Frederick described this analysis of the non-supersymmetric state, and he also described an analysis how you might understand this from a low-energy point of view. I rather not disparage the low-energy point of view, because what I want to stress about is the low-energy point of view indicates that the result is generic and robust and not necessarily particular to one class of states. Okay? So the basic idea is just to say, well, how would you get low-energy supersymmetry on this branch? Well, the easiest way would be to have one light field responsible for supersymmetry breaking. And if you just simply write down the most general effective action you can write for this field and assume a uniform distribution of these parameters, okay, you reproduce this counting of Douglas and Vinet. So I'm not going to go through that again. I would like to say, though, that one point about this, it's kind of nice that you could reproduce this, but one of the things you learn about this branch bothers me a lot. Not so much, well, I'd like to predict low-energy supersymmetry, but the other problem with this branch is the states. What this tells you is the states are all up at the high scale. Okay, so there are almost no states at low scale. And apart from the fact that supersymmetry is broken by a large amount, this also means that all the kinds of approximations we'd like to use to study these states are breaking down. Okay, so what we can say about these states is not totally clear. Okay, so I'm almost done. I'd like to say that on each of these branches, there is some phenomenology you can do. On the low-scale branch, the low-scale branch is suggestive of gauge mediation with a relatively low scale for breaking. Okay, it has also serious cosmological problems. And of course, one of the things we just learned is there probably aren't that many states here, so maybe we don't have to think about this. Maybe we shouldn't think about this branch. The intermediate scale breaking situation is somewhat more interesting, I think. If you take, for example, the KKLT scheme literally, okay, and you assume, for example, that matter is on, say, B7 brains, okay, then you find that Gugino's are much lighter than squarks and sleptons. You find that dark matter is likely to be Nuino. I'm not going to explain all this now, but I just want to indicate that there's a sort of rich, one can hope to do a rather rich phenomenology. There are a lot of things we don't really know to say these things reliably, so a lot of this is sort of at the level of conjecture. Okay, and the high-scale breaking is perhaps additional motivation for exploring, say, the phenomenology of Technicolor or Randall-Sundberg. Okay, I think it will be challenging, if this is the right picture, to relate this to any kind of microphysical understanding. Okay, I'm going to skip this slide on split supersymmetry. These results, especially the results on the R-symmetric states, have implications for ideas about split supersymmetry, okay? But I just wanted to end with a few lessons. First, the statistics of vacua, of many classes of vacua, follow from rather simple considerations, things like the assumptions of dense sets of states, smoothness of distribution functions, and Wilsonian effective Lagrangian reasoning. And within different branches, you can make phenomenological statements. Okay. Much more detailed microscopic understanding is required, for example, to decide which of these branches the theory might choose. And at present, I think the best one can do is hypothesize that nature lies in one or another of these branches. But I've given some tentative evidence that the low-energy branch at least might be suppressed. So what would I like to do now? What do I think we should do now? Well, I think within the sorts of program that Michael and Frederick reviewed, I think one of the things we'd really like to understand more of is the statistics of gauge symmetries. For example, is dynamical supersymmetry breaking at low energies common? We'd like to know more about details of things like the ranks of groups. This is really part of this point. This might give more insight into the more detailed phenomenology. So the sorts of things I described briefly in a couple transparencies ago relied on assumptions about how these distributions might look. But really knowing that is necessary to settle these kinds of questions. Okay. One thing I don't understand at all, and I think is really important, is the question of unification in the landscape. And then there are, of course, all these hard questions. And again, as Nima reminded us, we have just a little over 2 years. Okay.
Question, please.
Hello, topic.
Perfect.